Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
You know, they say winners never quit and quitters never win. In Zimbabwe, this is political realism. While it seems that incumbent President Robert Mugabe will never quit, his opponent Morgan Tsvangirai has pulled out of Friday's runoff charging violence. Who can't win? If you guess the people of Zimbabwe, you're ready for The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, June 23rd, and we look at what's next in Zimbabwe and also for the price of oil after an inconclusive meeting in Saudi Arabia. No news may be good news for your DNA and your peace of mind. Also, a gumshoe detective and contaminated tomatoes, young voters and how they get their news, the future of the Anglican Church, and remembering George Carlin, that and all the news. Zimbabwe's runoff presidential election will go ahead on Friday with only President Robert Mugabe on the ballot. Opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai pulled out of the election process yesterday, citing violence against his supporters. Government leaders say he must formally withdraw to stop the election.
The courageous people of Zimbabwe, of this country, and the people of the MDC have done everything humanly and democratically possible to deliver a new Zimbabwe under a new government.
Today, the U.S. and Britain are supposed to call on the U.N. Security Council to consider taking action against the longtime leader, Robert Mugabe. More on this story coming up.
After weeks of flooding in the Midwest, the Mississippi River is finally hitting its high water mark. The National Weather Service forecasts crests today downstream from Hannibal to Clarksville, Missouri. Conservative Anglican Church leaders began a week-long meeting yesterday. They represent 35 million members, threatening to break away over the church's acceptance of women and gay bishops. Rescuers in the Philippines say they may bore a hole in the hull of a ferry that capsized Saturday in a desperate effort to find survivors. 750 passengers and crew were on board.
At a summit yesterday, Saudi Arabia pledged to increase oil production this year if the market requires it. The pledge fell short of U.S. hopes and may do little to lower prices in the short term. In fact, oil prices already rose more than a dollar in Asian trading today. They're up to $136.49 a barrel. And at the gas pump, a new Lundberg survey finds the national average is $4.10 a gallon.
That's more than a dollar higher than last year. Finally, we have this.
We're history.
Comedian George Carlin died yesterday of heart failure in Santa Monica, California. He was a legend for mixing humor, politics, savage irony, and a deep love of truth and language. For saying what many thought but few would actually say. Like this less than charitable description of the founding fathers.
This was a small group of unelected white male landholding slave owners who also suggested their class be the only one allowed to vote. Now that is what's known as being stunningly and embarrassingly full of shit.
See, we can't even say it. George Carlin did. He died yesterday at age 71.
We want you to send us your memories of George Carlin. What's your favorite moment? What were his favorite words to you? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Here's one.
Yeah, this is Anthony from Brewster, New York. George Carlin was one of the best. I loved everything he did. Great man, and I'm going to miss him.
Besides your memories of George Carlin, you can weigh in on anything on the show. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
We in the MDC have resolved that we will no longer participate in this violent, illegitimate sham of an election process.
That Zimbabwe opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai pulling out of a runoff election that was just or is just 5 days away. What happens now in Zimbabwe? Peter Gresta with the BBC joins us from Johannesburg. And Peter, good morning. What does happen now?
Very good question. We understand from the Zimbabwean government, from the Information Minister Sikonyiso Ndlovu, that they will still go ahead with the election. Mr. Ndlovu told me that the Zimbabwean people would not be denied their right to vote. But I think this is important for the Zimbabwean government because all along what they've wanted above all else is the legitimacy that an election and an inauguration ceremony would confer on Robert Mugabe. And I think at the moment what we're seeing is a lot of diplomatic community to try and press the Zimbabwean government to avoid that election, to cancel the whole thing and get down to some serious negotiations. But frankly, at this stage, at least according to Mr. Ndlovu, the government really is in no mood for negotiations.
Peter, that actually sounds like an oxymoron to suggest that if this election moves forward and Robert Mugabe wins, that somehow that legitimizes his rule because he would automatically win, wouldn't he?
Well, he would automatically win, but I think what they need, what the government really wants, is a number that shows that more voters cast or stuck an X in the box for Robert Mugabe than they did for Morgan Tsvangirai. Because remember, Morgan Tsvangirai, at least on paper, won the first round of the elections. He didn't get quite enough to take an absolute majority, which is what he would have needed to be declared the president in the first round, and that's why we're having this runoff. But he certainly came away with more votes than Robert Mugabe, and I think the government is desperate to get that figure reversed. And they're also very, very keen to go through the legal process so that Robert Mugabe has the legal legitimacy, the constitutional legitimacy, if not the popular legitimacy, so that he can stand up in front of the world leaders and in particular his neighbours and say, look, I am the duly elected leader of Zimbabwe, and any negotiations have to recognise that.
Let's talk about his neighbours, Peter. His neighbors have not been very critical of Robert Mugabe as the rest of the international community has been in the face of escalating violence toward this re-election bid. Do you think in part Tsvangirai did step down to force the 14 nations, some of them neighbors of the Southern African Development Community, to do something?
Well, I think, if anything, by staying in the running, I think Morgan Tsvangirai would have forced the region's hand even further because it was highly unlikely that the observers, particularly those from the region, would have endorsed the election as free and fair. And without that kind of endorsement, I think the region would have found it difficult to acknowledge Robert Mugabe's victory as legitimate. And so in some respects, I think by pulling out early, Morgan Tsvangirai might have done himself some disservice. But we have seen, particularly over the last few days...
Can I interrupt you right there? Disservice because even those neighbors in the last couple of days, some of the leaders have been saying that conditions were not good for a free and fair election. They have been openly critical in a way that we haven't necessarily seen in the past couple of months.
Exactly. What I'm saying is that if the election had gone through with the MDC's participation, the observers would have declared that it was deeply flawed. They would not have given it their endorsement. And that means that the region's leaders would have had some grounds on which to say we can't back this election victory any election victory for Robert Mugabe. And it would have been, they would have found it almost impossible to recognize him as the duly elected leader. Now, Robert Mugabe has at least some legal standing to declare himself the victor. And I think that makes it a little bit harder for the region's leaders to stand up to him. But having said that, I think we've seen a rupturing of what one diplomat has called the conspiracy of silence surrounding Robert Mugabe from the region's leaders. President Mugabe's strongest ally in the region, Eduardo José dos Santos, the Angolan president, wrote a letter to him, a public letter, on Friday, calling on him to respect democracy and condemning the way that he'd handled the elections. We've also seen Levi Mwanawasa, the Zambian president and the man who is also the current chairman of the Southern African Development Community, speak out very, very forcefully at a news conference yesterday in which he said that the election should not go ahead, and he called on the other SADC regional leaders to condemn the poll and condemn the way that President Mugabe has handled the election. So
and
I think we are seeing a shift of move.
I was about to say, and that's something that we certainly haven't seen for some time. So certainly more chapters to come, and perhaps Morgan Tsvangirai has left a bit of wiggle room in there. So we will see what happens and whether or not he truly is on that ballot come Friday. Peter Gresta, BBC correspondent in Johannesburg, thank you.
It's interesting to take away there being, is the conspiracy of silence going to get a little more noisy as we head into the election? And will it possibly even be called off? Doesn't sound like it necessarily will be. Yesterday, there was an emergency summit, maybe you didn't notice, in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. It was supposed to bring oil-producing countries and oil-consuming countries together to try to stabilize the record high price of oil. It did not do that, but it certainly showcased that the dispute is over whether speculators are causing the price of oil to be so high or producers not producing enough is causing the price of oil to be so high. That was the argument in Jeddah. Diana Enriquez is following this for the New York Times. Boy, this is a crazy market. Diana, and the emergency summit on Sunday simply adds more confusion, it seems to me. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
What would you say? Is there any way to know if a boost of production by the Saudis is going to have any immediate impact on the oil price?
Well, we can look at the trading since that announcement was made, and it doesn't look positive. Overnight trading, of course, these markets never close, and the price of oil is sliding upward rather than being depressed. There are a whole spectrum of reasons that would immediately explain that jump. Political unrest in Nigeria has been something that oil traders have been watching uneasily for some time, and it took a bad turn over the weekend, although a ceasefire looks like it might calm things down there. But that just illustrates what a complex series of forces move on the oil market on any given day.
I wonder if the complexity has reached a point where there's no way for one thing to move the markets. Let's talk about the two things that were discussed at the summit. It seems like there's plenty of argument in the market to say speculators are to blame and plenty of argument in the market to say producers are to blame. Is there any objective way of evaluating this?
Well, there have been any number of efforts at studies aimed at the speculative issue. The Times has reported on a number of these, and I think that we've got to sort of say that U.S. Energy Secretary Sam Bodman came pretty close to the mark when he said in Jeddah that there is no evidence we can find that speculators are driving futures prices. There have been, as I say, hastily done studies looking at the changes in the futures markets, the rise of institutional investment in the futures markets, and they have become an easy target for Washington. I think we got to remember, though, that they call them futures markets for a reason. Traders look forward in setting these markets to where they think prices are going to go in the future, and they see three really hard facts to ignore. One is that the oil industry, as we saw in Saudi Arabia, just can't easily boost production. It's just not mechanically and practically possible to quickly dial up the amount of oil that the planet can turn out. And similarly, it's going to be politically very difficult to dial back demand. You saw that China raised its subsidy prices late last week, which effectively it cut its subsidies, which effectively raised local prices for oil to try to turn back demand somewhat. China will probably get away with it, but some other South Asian countries have already cut subsidies, boosted local prices, and people are rioting in the streets.
Well, Diana, what do we make then, if this is an intransigent situation with demand and supply, of the campaign calls for curbs on so-called speculation or institutional investing in the oil markets?
Well, I think that's the third big thing that the oil markets are looking at with great worry. I think they see that it's becoming increasingly likely that there will be political intervention of some kind in Washington into these markets, and
whether,
the uncertainty
whether,
about what it's going to be. Is,
whether it's
is right.
McCain or Barack Obama as president.
They're almost outbidding each other in who can beat up on speculators hardest. So I don't think that this is going to fall on I think you're going to see the Bush administration on one side of this argument and both presidential candidates on the other.
Any easy way to distinguish Barack Obama and John McCain on this question of institutional investing in the few seconds that we have?
Well, we're going to have a number of congressional hearings coming up this week, starting today and continuing through Wednesday, and that will give us a little better insight into whether they're going to, what patch they're going to carve out to distinguish themselves.
Diane Enriquez of the New York Times, thank you very much. Diane Enriquez is a reporter for the New York Times covering the oil markets, and we'll have to look to Congress to give us some clarity here. I don't know if that's good
news.
Well,
it's fascinating because at the end of the day, we're all using more. The world is using more oil. So what's the debate about?
Well, the question is, who's driving the price up? Is it demand or is it supply? And is there supply? Is supply peak? That's really probably the most important issue.
We'll have more on this story, I bet.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday and it's June 23rd. Today we are remembering the comedian George Carlin, who died yesterday. Also, we're following the emergency meeting of OPEC to discuss the skyrocketing oil prices. And, well, one of you already have a thought on that.
Hi. I can't believe that you think that the reason for rising oil prices can only be some evil on the part of either producers or speculators. There may be some speculation, and the producers may do little tricks, but the largest effect is simply supply and demand.
Supply and demand or speculators? That's the question on the oil, the rising oil prices. Anyhow, we'll love to hear from you, as always, at 877-8-MY-TAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org. DNA, would you like to have your DNA tested, John?
Do you think there's something wrong with it?
No, not at all. Informational purposes.
Is there something, am I looking strange today?
You look lovely.
I'd love to know what's in my DNA.
Well, if you're in California today, you won't be able to do that if you go to 13 companies who specialize in DNA testing. The state of California has told them to give it up. They don't have the expertise. Wired reporter Alexis Madrigal, how does that work?
That's the basic idea. The state of California is saying that these tests haven't really been medically validated, although the way they're making the argument is largely procedural. They sent cease and desist letters to 13 companies saying basically you need to have a doctor involved in the process and your test results need to be validated. The only problem is that for a lot of the more complex tests, like the kind of genome-wide scans offered by like the most innovative companies in this space, Navigenics and 23andMe, it's kind of unclear what level of evidence the state wants to validate those tests.
Unclear because why?
Well, because, you know, the 13 companies that they've sent the letter to, we don't know all of them, but the ones that we know that they have really different businesses and they have really different types of genetic testing, and yet the identical letter was sent to all the companies. And so right now it kind of looks like this was more of a shot across the bow. Like this was like, hey, look, genetic testing companies, we're coming to get you, and you need to kind of watch out. And so today is the day that these genetic testing companies have to return fire and basically offer up some sort of compliance plan. And so right now, company sources that I've been in touch with are saying, hey, look, we're scrambling to do this. We're trying to get this done by the end of today. They've only had less than 2 weeks to put something together. At which point the ball will be back in the state of California.
Let's start at the beginning. The California officials say that the DNA companies are essentially practicing medicine without a license. What happens? I go in there, I give blood, and they give me a rundown of my DNA?
You actually don't even need to do that. You order the test on the internet. They send you a vial. You spit into it and send it back to them. They process your results, usually via kind of an outsourced lab. And then they present you with sort of some sort of genetic risk assessment about your various susceptibilities to heritable diseases. So that's the way that it would work. The state of California says a physician needs to initiate that test.
What are they worried about?
They're worried about, you know, there was a meeting that they had that Wired covered, basically saying they're worried about the worried well, that people will take these tests, find genetic information about themselves, and then use that to make clinically poor decisions. Now, what those decisions might be, because a lot of these kind of risk factors are about, you know, your risk of getting cancer, or you're going to live healthier, you're going to, like, work out more and smoke less. I mean, it's hard to tell exactly what it is that they're worried about.
It sounds like the state of California Health Department is worried about people in California having more anxiety. Whoa.
I mean, and I think it's a question of, are we really creating the worried well, or are people willing to spend $1,000 to $2,500 right now on these tests? Are they already worried, and that's why they're doing this? I mean, I think maybe down the road, like in a few years, when you see the cost of these tests dropping, you know, into like the double or triple digit dollars, so you're talking like $50 or $100 to get some of these things. But maybe at that point, you might worry about, you know, the mainstream market not quite being ready to understand this information. But if you're willing to plunk down $2,500, you're clearly willing to put some time in to understand the results that you've received.
It certainly has lit up the blogosphere. There's this one blog from Daniel at Genetic Future. He says, really what this boils down to is a turf war between old school medical models and the upstart advocates of free information kind of in this Google world. You buy that?
I do, actually. I really buy it. I think that at least at Wired, we're looking at this absolutely as an information wants to be free sort of situation. And I think if you look at the history of information, especially in the internet age, it's just kind of been a steamroller blowing away previous industries. And I think a lot of doctors right now are saying, hey, look, we're the ones who should be the gatekeepers for this information. On the other hand, I mean, basically, the rest of the consumer marketplace says the consumer is the person who's going to be in control.
Okay, so Alexis, today the ball is in the court of these 13 genetic testing companies. And we should note, obviously, people can get a prescription from their doctor to get their DNA testing. It would just happen within the medical universe as opposed to in the free market universe of these companies that offer it.
Right. It would be, yeah, they could. They're really trying to shut down direct-to-consumer testing.
Thanks, Alexis. Alexis Madrigal, reporter for Wired Magazine. We appreciate it. And now we're going to do some headlines. We're going to get the latest headlines from Femi Okeh.
Hello there. 28 minutes past the hour. The Mississippi River is hitting its high mark near the Iowa-Missouri border. That's its high water mark. More than 30 survivors have been found from a capsized ferry in the Philippines. The U.S. Navy ship is heading to the Philippines to help efforts to rescue hundreds that are still missing. And comedian George Carlin has died of heart failure at the age of 71. Now to the news in some more detail. In Northern California, wildfires sparked by lightning yesterday are still burning. Hundreds of wildfires flared up across the heart of Napa Valley wine country. Wayne Connor is from the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection.
The conditions are changing all the time, so you really kind of have to have a crystal ball.
Residents have been evacuated from the area and one home has already burned down. Oil prices are rising in overseas trading despite Saudi Arabia's announcement that it would put out more crude if needed. Oil has risen to more than a dollar a barrel. It's trading at $136.46 a barrel in Europe at the moment. The US-led coalition in Afghanistan has announced it killed 55 militants, including three key leaders on Friday. The news comes the same day that NATO General Egon Rams says up to 6,000 additional troops are needed in Afghanistan. He warns that failure to deploy the extra NATO troops will prolong the alliance's presence in the country. The NATO troops are supposed to be out of Afghanistan by 2012. And Beijing officials are trying to reduce pollution before the Summer Olympics by taking some government vehicles off the roads and using license plate numbers to alternate days passenger cars can be on the road. Officials say that these measures will reduce pollution by about 60%. So the athletes may well be able to see each other as they're competing in the Summer Olympics, which begins August the 8th.
We tried that in the States back in the 70s. I don't think the alternate license plate thing worked very well.
I heard that people bought two license plates, which is cheating.
Two cars, yeah, and they took gas cans with them. Yeah. Femi, okay, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Well, that was a vivid recollection of people with their gas cans.
Right, is there something wrong with that? I'm having a flashback? Oh my God. Put down the weapon!
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Mandy and Lester, a short film about a girl who loses two boxes of Scout cookies, a boy who finds those cookies, and who finds that returning them isn't going to be as simple as it seems. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. You can join our conversation at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We've been talking about speculation in the oil markets, your opinion on who's to blame for higher oil prices. We're also remembering George Carlin. You can leave your remembrances at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'll have many more later on in the program. We also have an opportunity for you to speculate. Yes, you, the listener, can speculate on the Veep Stakes, the 2008 Veep Stakes. There's lots of speculation about who John McCain and Barack Obama are going to pick as their running mates. And that's perfect for a stock trading game, and we've made one. Game is new, but Facebook users are already buying and selling vice presidential candidates. If you look right now, Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius is number one on Obama's Veep Stakes list, and Carly Fiorina, former Hewlett-Packard CEO, is edging out Florida Governor Charlie Crist on McCain's list. They all seem
two
plausible.
Two women.
Yeah, that's big. And, you know, the question is, what's the future contract in those potential Veeps? Will people learn something from playing by weighing in? You can play the game. Tell us if you learn anything. There's a link to the game on our homepage at thetakeaway.org. And the idea is the prices for the various choices are based on coverage and blogs and mainstream media. So it's not simply the number of people who weigh in. So if all of Carly's like friends weigh in, it will be mediated by the amount of coverage as well. So that's one way you can get information in this political campaign. Matt Glazer, editor of BurntOrangeReport.com. Matt?
Good to be here.
What's your favorite Twitter, which is another way to get information on the political campaign in 2008?
Well, it's been Twitter's been a flutter this morning, hearing about veterans issues in Texas with U.S. Senate candidate Rick Noriega and economic issues with Senator Barack Obama. And so it's been fun. The phone's been buzzing a lot this morning.
Now, you're on the estimated 41,000 member list of the Obama Twitter network, right?
I am.
And that compares with John McCain's roughly 735 Twitter members?
It is. And it's fun to see how the different campaigns are using technology this time around.
What do you think the difference is?
Well, I think that the Senator Obama's campaign is using technology for both information and giving it out there to the masses, but also using it to organize their people. I thought it was amazing that he was disseminating information about FEC and saying that he wasn't taking public financing hours before it was becoming public knowledge and telling people to go to his website. And I think that that's just the way he's using that information.
So that news was broken on Twitter. Matt, how old are you?
I'm 26 years old.
26 years old. In the studio with us is our friend David Wall Rice, who's assistant professor of psychology at Morehouse College in New York. Young people using different sources for political news. Is Matt's experience typical of what you're seeing at Morehouse?
It really is typical. You really do see people using new media in more meaningful, different ways. So a lot of the typical kind of age media of the evening news and the newspaper and even the magazine are giving way to things like MSN Online or MSNBC, CNN, and things like that. And that's what we're getting a lot from, actually, students in a critical thinking class that I'm teaching that's looking at voter identity and how individuals are defining how they're going to vote for folks.
Now, it affects how they consume news, what the inputs are for the students. How does it affect their behavior on, say, the outputs, either their propensity to vote or their propensity to be politically active?
Well, I think the thing that's so interesting is that there's a lot of information out there. And what I found in these kind of new students who are coming in, I'm teaching freshmen right now, and so we're doing kind of this idea of how to be a critical, engaged voter. There's a lot of information coming in, but they don't necessarily know what to do with it yet. And so the thing that's kind of coming out on the back end is, oh, I have all this access to information, but in terms of synthesizing it and making it, you know, part of who they are and in terms of action items and agenda items, things like that.
Or what's true and what's false,
yes,
even that.
Things are getting kind of lost in translation, so that's something that we're working on a bit in the class, at least.
Matt, aside from going to burntorangereport.com, how do people sort out the difference between what's true and what's false, what to weigh and what to ignore?
Well, I think our generation especially is very good about taking in different types of media. I start my day the same way I think most people do. in the sense that I turn my TV on to local news and national news, and I start reading the blogs on RSS feeders and blog lines. So I'm getting both the new media and the traditional media at the same time. So I think that we're still seeing that overlap.
But that doesn't mean you necessarily know which to ignore and which to pay attention to.
Well, you know, the fun part is the more you take in, the more information you get to just play around with. And that marketplace of ideas being opened up larger, it just creates a better debate. I know that on our site, we allow for that marketplace. And when people disagree with us, we just simply have that discussion.
Hmm. David, you know, one of the things you were talking about earlier this morning is how this access to news, but also the ability to push into this marketplace mm-hmm. that Matt is talking about right. changes the equation. It makes people more likely to want to register their views
Absolutely.
And not simply listen. How does that manifest itself?
Well, I mean, I think that everybody's an editor is something that we've talked about a little bit earlier. And the thing is everybody really an editor? Are these really informed opinions that are kind of going out there in the blogosphere or in, you know, in the internet that's consumed by so many different people? So the thing that we have to kind of keep in mind, especially for these folks that we're talking to at Morehouse, these are first-time voters. So, you know, a lot of the information that they're taking in and wanting to give out aren't well informed and thought out. So, again, it becomes...
But they're passionate.
They're very yeah. passionate, but it becomes important to kind of exercise this critical thought and really vetting the information and making sure that it kind of really does make sense.
David Walrice, stay with us. Matt Glazer, quickly before we go, does everyone want a swift boat with their SMS flitter, Twitter feed?
There's definitely a group of people out there, but doesn't mean that we all try to play that game, so... Just you got to find the credible sources and stick with them because those are the ones where you're going to actually get some news.
Matt Glazer, editor of BurntOrangeReport.com. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now we have headlines from Femi. Okay, Femi.
Hello there. 21 minutes to the hour. Saudi Arabia pledges to put out more oil this year if it's needed. Nigerian militants begin a ceasefire at midnight and play is underway at Wimbledon. Zimbabwe's opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai has pulled out of Friday's runoff election, citing violence. We spoke earlier to the BBC's Peter Grester. He says that Tsvangirai's withdrawal may in fact give President Robert Mugabe more power.
All along, what they've wanted above all else is the legitimacy that an election and an inauguration ceremony would confer on Robert Mugabe.
President Mugabe has vowed to go ahead with the runoff presidential vote on Friday. The effects of Midwest flooding will soon show in food prices, probably as early as November. An estimated 2 million or more acres of corn and soybean fields have been damaged. High prices are already affecting the cost of animal feed, and livestock owners say that they've been forced to slaughter more animals than they normally would. And the Supreme Court begins what's probably its final week of work before its summer break. The court has 10 cases left to decide, among them gun rights and whether the death penalty is permissible for rape. After 5 years, U.S. beef will be on the menus in South Korea. Bowing to strong protests in South Korea, the United States Department of Agriculture has agreed that all imported beef will come from cows that are less than 3.5 years old. And that's a look at your domestic and international headlines for now.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
So I said you're here in New York, but I didn't mean to say Morehouse College is here in New York. Morehouse College, as everyone knows, is in Atlanta.
Atlanta, Georgia.
And you're in New York because you're lost, right, David?
I'm lost.
Took a wrong turn on I-95.
Help me.
And thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
I'm John Hockenberry.
And this morning we are remembering George Carlin, the comedian, the iconic and legendary comedian. He died yesterday at the age of 71. And we have just gotten a flood of responses from listeners who are remembering what they loved best about George Carlin. Listen.
Alex Cuccinero-Gorman, New Jersey. Even though he got belligerent in his later years, I'll always be fond of his long rant about religion and the invisible man in the sky who watches everything you do every minute of every day.
I tried to believe that there is a God who created each of us in his own image and likeness, loves us very much, and keeps a close eye on things. I really tried to believe that, but I gotta tell you, the longer you live, the more you look around, the more you realize something is f***ed up. Something is wrong here. War, disease, death, destruction, hunger, filth, poverty, torture, crime, corruption, and the ice capades.
Yes, faith was not an antidote for George Carlin's disbelief, and he took that to the end. I actually like the belligerent George Carlin, but there were very many personal connections with George Carlin. I actually have one and I'll talk about it in a minute, but here's one remembrance of a listener growing up listening to the comedian.
Lee from Briarcliff. My favorite George Carlin moment was bringing home the Class Clown album, which was the seven words you can't say on television, sitting down and listening to the entire album with my parents and getting to the last track on the album, which was the seven words, and just sitting there with my parents laughing nervously as he uttered all seven words and ripped them apart. I'd never said any of those words before them. I'd never heard. It was just terrible. Just terrible.
I wish we could show you the look on his parents' face right when they had that conversation, but of course we can't say those seven words here on the radio either.
Carlin talked about so many things so frankly, and race was one of those things. Let's listen to George Carlin on race.
Yeah, my favorite George Carlin revelation was an HBO thing. He said, tonight I'm going to talk about white people. And he said, stop pretending to be black. This is the blue-eyed daredevil from Boston, Mass.
Daredevil.
So what was Carlin like off the stage? If you ever saw him on talk shows, you got maybe a hint of it. But here's one listener's remembrance of that.
My name is Joe French. I remember Carlin when I did a concert up in Waterbury, Connecticut. Ticket sales were low, and so he was kind enough to answer the telephone for us. People called up to get information, and they actually spoke to George Carlin, and they wouldn't believe they actually were speaking to him. And he was a great entertainer, very down to earth, and just a wonderful guy.
What a life George Carlin had, right? He enjoyed his laughs, he enjoyed sharing his thoughts, he dealt with a little addiction, had a few money troubles, came
huge
back and
performer.
Talked a little bit more about his songs. Let's listen to a little bit of the softer side of George Carlin.
Hello, my name is Carmela LaGamba Bodhi. I'm calling from Long Island, and my remembrance of George Carlin is him as a narrator of Thomas the Tank Engine stories after growing up with the seven words you can't say on television.
Well done, Thomas. You are right on time and really reliable.
Thank you, sir, whistled Thomas.
Ooh, right on time and really reliable, hummed the coaches.
But the big engines were not feeling cheerful at all.
Where's Percy, mumbled Henry. He's supposed to fetch our coaches.
My kids remember George Carlin and his fans of Thomas the Tank. George Carlin died yesterday at age 71. Your remembrance is at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
You are about to see is true. The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
Christine Humphrey, should we call you a food detective?
You could call me a former investigator, now food and drug attorney.
Former FDA investigator, and right now some of your former colleagues are on the hunt. They're looking for a rare form of salmonella in tomatoes. So far, it's made more than 500 people sick in more than three dozen states. Christine, why is it so difficult for them to find the source of this contamination?
Well, you know, it's a coordinated effort with CDC, other federal agencies, state and local governments, and it takes quite a bit of time to coordinate those efforts. Many of the distributors and packing houses have different types of records that they keep. Sometimes they're incomplete. So by the time you start to narrow things down and coordinate efforts, several weeks, if not months, can pass.
And tell us, how do you do it? Where do you start?
Well, generally, the Emergency Operations Center and FDA's headquarters will begin coordinating efforts, sending out individual directed inspections to various districts, and you start from there.
Is it all paperwork?
Most of it is in the beginning, until you get to the point of starting to target out certain farms.
And then what happens?
At that point in time, you start looking at field management practices, what occurs in the packing houses, water systems, things like that. It's more of a hands-on approach once you get to the farm level.
Oh, I really want a bubble suit. I want a whole CSI set of tools. Come on.
Well, it actually doesn't happen that way. I mean, it's difficult. Each farm, the practices that occur there are different. And so it's a difficult effort once you get to the farm level.
But don't you go there with your vial and your cotton swab? I mean, isn't that how you test whether or not there are tomatoes that have been infected by the salmonella that you're looking for if you were working on this case?
Yeah, I mean, I've done tracebacks before, specifically for tomatoes in Florida. And yes, there's environmental testing that's conducted. Yes, there's swabbing that occurs in the packing plant as well. But, you know, it's difficult. It's not really an exact science.
Let's talk very quickly about produce not having the same safety protocols as meat and poultry. Does that make it more difficult to trace down the source where exactly produce has come from?
Absolutely, it does. There's no lot number or coding requirement that's uniform across the states or for imported products as well. And so you get a lot of commingling once these products are either imported or distributed from the producer to a packing house. It's very easy for the product to be commingled.
And that's why you need food detectives like yourself, Christine, right, to track it down.
Correct.
Christine Humphrey, former FDA investigator, current lawyer, and also someone who does advise the FDA on policy. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And star of the new movie, Traceback.
Traceback,
yes. Actually, this is an actual movie. Did you ever see this?
No, actually, I didn't.
This was a classic.
Okay.
Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. We should remind people no one has actually died from the salmonella.
No, it just caused people to be ill, yes.
Sick, or maybe wish that their lives would end. That's just how miserable salmonella is. We're going to shift focus now. Conservative Anglican leaders have opened talks in Jerusalem. Clergy are in Jerusalem who represent three main branches of the Anglican faith, conservative Anglicans from Britain, the U.S. Episcopal Church, and the African archbishops of Nigeria and Uganda are all in a major dispute over the future of the worldwide Anglican communion. Joining us now is Robert Pigott, who's a BBC religious affairs correspondent. Robert, what is at stake in these talks, and why are they in Jerusalem?
What's at stake is the entire future of the Anglican Communion. Bear in mind, this is the largest Protestant grouping in the world. It's very unwieldy, and it normally meets once every 10 years for something called the Lambeth Conference, which is important for knitting it together. But this group of traditionalists from America, as you say, and all around the world, especially the developing world, have got so frustrated with the American church and its ordination of the gay bishop Gene Robinson and its blessing of same-sex relationships in church that they're boycotting the Lambeth Conference, and this is the rival conference held in Jerusalem. Now, why Jerusalem? It's the symbolism. It's because they want to go back to the earliest teaching of the church, and they say that that is sort of available in spiritually in Jerusalem. They say that the first Christians would have seen the Bible in a much more strict and literal way, and that would have ruled out active homosexuality, among other things.
Well, keeping the symbolism at the center is going to be a real challenge for this meeting, and here in the words of Assistant Bishop of Kampala, David Zach Mingeriai from Uganda, he declares that this really isn't about homosexuality and doctrinal concerns at all. It's about something much bigger.
The issue is not homosexuality at all. Homosexuality is simply the presenting issue. There is a much deeper issue. The much deeper question has to do with authority. If you are able to bless actions that are clearly against Scripture, and Scripture is the foundation of our faith. So this is not about homosexuality. No.
Robert, what do you make of those remarks from the Bishop of Uganda?
I think what he's saying is something echoed by a lot of people here. They get slightly tired of the idea that they are taking such extreme action because of an issue like sexuality. It's the presenting issue for a much deeper fear on their part, which is that the church is starting to reinterpret the Bible to suit prevailing modern mores, moral values. And they're saying that if it goes on doing that, it will cease to have anything to offer the world at all and will change its nature entirely. So homosexuality, in a way that nothing else has ever done in the 500-year history of Protestantism, and remember it's gone through things like ordaining women, which was a huge storm, but homosexuality has divided people over this issue of how you interpret the Bible. Does the Bible rule it out or not? Is the Bible about something else entirely, about loving your neighbour as yourself and being inclusive and including everyone in the family, whatever their lifestyle is like? So those are the issues, the much deeper issues that have prompted this rift and prompted this conference.
Well, as a last question, Robert, is it possible that this is also about the emergence of the African church as a kind of center of power in Christian denominations, not only thinking of the Anglican Communion here?
Yes, if you look back 100 years, you'd find three quarters roughly of Anglicans lived in America and Europe and in the sort of British Empire, the British Commonwealth, in the predominantly white developed countries. Now it's the other way around. 75% roughly live in developing countries, and they tend to be black and women. They tend to be single mothers. They tend to be HIV positive. They're people like that. The centre of gravity has shifted dramatically in the Anglican Church and in other churches. And these populous churches are beginning to realise that they may have relatively few bishops to go to Lambeth, although they do have increasing numbers of bishops, but they do have this huge membership, and they should be not told what to do by the countries who first brought them the gospel and then decide 100 years later to change the rules of the Bible. And that is one of the big things here, this idea of colonialism persisting. But I think the centre of gravity shifting to the south is also reflecting the fact that a lot of these people live cheek by jowl with Muslims, who have an even more conservative attitude towards homosexuality and other social issues, and also the fact they come from African societies, which are quite different from the ones that are emerging in the West. So all those pressures have come to bear and have helped to crack open this rift more and more steadily in the Anglican Church, which, as I said, for 500 years has lived with difference very happily.
And Robert Pigott, BBC religious affairs correspondent. Robert, thank you very much.
Well, that doesn't sound like it's going to be anything decided anytime soon.
No, and it's interesting how the politics are changing there. Even though the Western churches have more bishops, they don't have more parishioners, and that's ultimately where the center of mass is. Keep your responses coming to anything you heard on today's show. Send us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and boy, you are this morning.
We're talking about Zimbabwe, oil prices, DNA, and investigating salmonella in tomatoes. Here's one suggestion on that story.
Hi, this is Jeremy Stern calling from Marion, Massachusetts. If you have to have those annoying little stickers on each piece of fruit, it seems like it should be fairly easy to trace them by putting a number on those stickers.
Yeah, there's a good one.
We're also hearing your remembrances about the death of George Carlin.
My name is Gideon Levy from Brooklyn, New York, and I just heard on your radio show that George Carlin died, and I am devastated. I always loved his absolute irreverence. I loved his anti-religiosity, and I really loved when he played a cardinal in the Kevin Smith movie Dogma. So, George Carlin, rest in peace to you.
I'll miss the hippy-dippy weatherman myself.
He was funny. And we have your movie reviews on our website, thetakeaway.org. You did not have much love for The Love Guru this weekend.
Can we please remove the comic genius tag from Mike Myers now?
While you're there, check out our new Facebook game. It's called 2008 Veep Stakes. You can buy and sell potential running mates for Barack Obama and John McCain. David Walrice, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we're on YouTube, iTunes, and Facebook.
We are. We want you to join the discussion any way you can, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Bye-bye.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.